A pleasant good morning wherever you are. Welcome to the 22nd day of February 2020 broadcast of Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead. As always, that's me. We're coming to you with the magic of 21st century broadcasting through the renowned studios of Radio 1490 WGCH in the Central Business District of Greenwich, Connecticut, here in the USA. We're also streaming online to all four corners of the world through WGCH.com, anywhere over the internet. We've got a great show for you today, so sit back, relax, and without any further delay, let's get started.
Coming up on today's show,
Dr. Ken Ruoff returns to the broadcast. He is the professor of history and director of the Center for Japanese Studies at Portland State University, Oregon. Japan's Imperial House in the post-war era, 1945 to 2019, has just been released. It is published by Harvard University Asia Center and available on Amazon or your preferred book vendor. We will have all this and more as today's show unfolds. Don't go away.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after these important messages. Welcome to Conversations with Jeffrey Bingham Mead, your host.
Dr. Ken Ruoff is the professor of history and director of the Center for Japanese Studies at Portland State University, Oregon. In 2014, the Japanese Consul General of Portland, Oregon, presented him with a commendation for improving the understanding of Japan and also enriching the cultural life of Portland, both through programs inspired by his scholarship and programs sponsored by the Center for Japanese Studies. Ruoff received his AB with honors from Harvard College and his PhD from Columbia University. He was a research fellow, then lecturer in the Faculty of Law at Hokkaido University, and in 2004 he was a visiting Fulbright Fellow at the Institute for Research in the Humanities at Kyoto University. Dr. Ruoff is recognized as a leading authority on the Imperial House in Japan, often writing commentary for Japanese journals, and he has been interviewed by virtually every major media outlet in the world. In 2004, Ruoff was awarded the Osaragi Jiro Prize for Commentary. This is Japan's equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize for the Japanese translation of his book, The People's Emperor, Democracy, and the Japanese Monarchy, 1945 to 1995. Now, with the ascension of a new emperor and the dawn of the Reiwa era, Ruoff has produced an expanded and updated study of the monarchy's role as a political, societal, and cultural institution in contemporary Japan. Japan's Imperial House in the post-war era, 1945 to 2019, has just been released. It's published by Harvard University Asia Center and available on Amazon or your preferred book vendor. Dr. Ken Ruoff is with me by phone from Portland State University, Oregon. Good morning, Ken, and welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
The cover of your book, I love the cover of this book because it features an image of Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko bowing and facing the ocean. And I wanted to know if you would tell us the backstory of this image and its significance.
Yes, I'd be happy to. But let me preface my answer by stressing that the monarchy is a particularly good window to understanding Japan. Because it's actually through the monarchy that the Japanese define the national identity. What I mean by that is this is how they define what it means to be Japanese and what they believe that Japan is all about, what Japan represents. And so if the United States had a monarchy that operated as that of Japan does, we would be arguing through the monarchy issues such as whether or not we are to remain a nation of immigrants. And Emperor Akihito had some very clear messages that he wanted to send as emperor, both to his countrymen and to individuals beyond Japan. Now, the cover photo is instantly recognizable to all Japanese, but admittedly does require explanation on this side of the Pacific. The context is Saipan, and the year is 1995, the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. And Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko are facing what is known as Banzai Cliff. Hmm. In fact, they're praying in the direction of Banzai Cliff. At the end of the Battle of Saipan in 1944, hundreds and hundreds of Japanese, including large numbers of civilians, threw themselves off these cliffs rather than surrender to the Americans. And the imperial couple is praying for the repose of their souls. The photo symbolizes one of the most prominent aspects of the agenda of Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko during their three-decade reign from 1989 to 2019. They devoted just endless efforts to trying to bring closure to the wounds of the war. Their efforts were not just directed domestically, but also internationally, with apologies to neighboring countries, for example. There's no term more associated with Emperor Akihito than peace. Mm-hmm. He was a tireless advocate for peace, but not in a simplistic sense. He knew that it was necessary for his country to come to terms with the war, including Japan's responsibility for it.
Now, this new book of yours is an expanded edition of your earlier work, The People's Emperor, and considered to be a landmark study of the Japanese monarchy. Talk us, if you would, through the research process, your access to source material, and even some of the challenges that you might have faced.
Sure. I think it's fair to say that there are some documents held by the Imperial Household Agency that if any researcher goes there and asks for them, you'll just get a polite no. So there's no point bothering. But at the same time, at this point in history, we don't really need those documents to get quite a good understanding of the monarchy. But there were two chapters that presented challenges in different ways. The third chapter about the briefings that the emperor continued to receive from the prime minister and other government officials even after the new constitution went into effect in 1947 was a difficult one to research. It was detective work, piecing together from numerous diaries, etc., comments and questions that Emperor Hirohito was said to have made during his meetings with government officials. And Japanese scholars had themselves done some of the detective work. And what emerged from the detective work, when you pieced as many of the pieces of the puzzle together as you could get your hands on, was a clear pattern indicating that even after the new constitution went into effect, it transformed the emperor's legal position into a symbol with no formal political power. Emperor Hirohito continued to believe that he had an important role in politics to play. So constitutions can change overnight, but that doesn't mean that people's ways of doing things change overnight. After all, Emperor Hirohito had spent the first 20 years of his reign at the apex of the political process, so it's perhaps less surprising that he would continue to think that he had an important role in politics to play than it is to think that he would just suddenly understand that the new constitution was designed to keep him out of politics and he just needed to stop intervening in politics.
Yeah, speaking of the post-war constitution, now it did reform the emperor's public role, and your book provides a variety of revelations that I found very interesting about the behind-the-scenes aspect, his private role, and if you would maybe shed a little bit of light on that for us.
Yes, there are various sides to the emperor's private role, some of which are not particularly surprising, such as his marriage and his family life, although we'll want to return to the issue of family life when it comes to the present emperor and empress. But there are other aspects which are far more dramatic. For example, the emperor remains the high priest of the Shinto religion in his private capacity. Mm-hmm. This means that the emperor regularly performs all sorts of Shinto rituals inside the palace, most of which pass unnoticed by a large percentage of Japanese, but on the other hand, are of tremendous significance to other Japanese. So there are some Japanese who view these Shinto rituals as problematic, whereas other Japanese view them as fundamental to the emperor's role. They think that that's what's the most important thing about the emperor is the fact that he is, you know, praying on behalf of the nation state, for example. So in Japan, there can be numerous, often dissenting viewpoints about just about any aspect of the imperial house, including the emperor's private role as the high priest of Shinto. But viewed from a different perspective, one of the greatest challenges for any royal family member these days is to try to maintain some sort of genuinely private life. And it's not necessarily any easier
for Japanese royals than it is for British royals in this area. And also, once one becomes emperor, there's not so much time for private pursuits. Emperor Emeritus Akihito had a genuine scientific interest and even expertise in the area of marine biology, specifically in the study of tiny fish known as gobies. And one of his joys is when he had a chance to pursue his this sort of research. But once he becomes emperor, there's very few opportunities to do this. Now, when it came to the present emperor and empress, in a way that was very traumatic, what normally would have been a very private affair became a public issue. And this was because of the paucity of male heirs to the throne. Mm-hmm. So the fact that as crown prince and crown princess, the Norihito and Masako did not produce a boy, you know, the necessary heir to the throne, suddenly became a national issue, a public issue. And we now know that it is true, that it was true, that then Crown Princess Masako was put under tremendous pressure. I mean, they finally have a child after many years of trying. It turns out to be a girl. They want to enjoy their newborn daughter, all the wonders of being first-time parents. And they're basically told to get back to the bedroom and produce that male heir. And, of course, that doesn't happen. And so there are times when normally private affairs become very painfully public affairs for these royals as well.
So we have a remarkable transformation with Emperor Hirohito, transiting from the wartime emperor to the pacifist. It's a fascinating transformation. Talk to us about the importance of the emergence of what is called the Imperial House of Diplomacy, and even if you would touch a little bit upon that issue of the war responsibility and the apologies.
I do want to stress that not all of not all Japanese or people worldwide necessarily believed the effort to transform Emperor Hirohito into a pacifist. But nonetheless, there was a massive campaign from the moment of the surrender by both the Japanese American and American sides to distance Emperor Hirohito from the war, in fact, to transform him into a pacifist.
Yeah.
The Americans wanted to use Emperor Hirohito to legitimize the reforms of the occupation, and that's exactly what they did. And that also explains their desire to distance him from the war. On the Japanese side, the goal, of course, was to preserve not only the institution, which was threatened.
Yeah.
It was threatened after the war, not only to preserve the institution itself from abolition, but to protect Hirohito, the individual. And it's a complicated story. I sometimes get asked, was Hirohito a dictator along the lines of Hitler or Mussolini? No, definitely not. And then the next question sometimes is, oh, was he a robot? No, he wasn't a robot either. It's complicated. He often let politics be carried out by his ministers and elected officials. But on the other hand, he did periodically intervene, and not always in the good ways that conservative historians in Japan try to stress. They put big emphasis on his decision to intervene and effect a surrender. They put much less emphasis on the fact that late in the war, he's actually pushing for the imperial military to achieve some sort of victory so a negotiated instead of unconditional surrender can be effected. So he can be seen as having prolonged the war as well. It is true that Hirohito maintained grave reservations about war with the United States, but he did eventually sanction it. That's undeniable. The notion that he was a pacifist is ludicrous, okay? It's more the case that he pragmatically questioned the wisdom of entering a war whose chances for victory for Japan seemed a long shot. That's the real question he's asking. Is this war winnable? Not whether war itself is appropriate.
Right.
And remember, everybody should remember that Japan had been at war for 10 years on the Asian continent before the attack on Pearl Harbor. So Hirohito was no pacifist, but he was also no warmonger. But he definitely bore what came to be known in the post-war period as war responsibility. I use this phrase, came to be known in the post-war period, because the concept of war responsibility is largely a post-war construct. Yeah. And so he unquestionably had war responsibility, at least in a moral sense. And it's problematic in a lot of ways that he stayed on the throne until 1989, never once explicitly apologizing for the war publicly. And the fact that the most powerful symbol of Japan's imperialism and wars of aggression, Emperor Hirohito, remained on the throne this long into the post-war era made it difficult, especially for people in the neighboring countries, to believe that there was anything new about post-war Japan. Yeah. But this was a real shame, because post-war Japan truly is different in many significant ways from Imperial Japan. Mm-hmm. The attachment to peace is real. In fact, large numbers of Japanese define democracy as including peace. I would really urge all listeners to mull that over at length. They define democracy as including peace. There's no other democratic country in the world that has such a definition of democracy. What happens is that it falls to Hirohito's son, Akihito, to try to clean up his father's mess. So Akihito spent a good part of his reign trying to bring closure to various legacies of the war, wounds of the war, through imperial diplomacy. He apologized to Korea when the president of Korea visited in 1990. In 1992, during a visit to China, he issued a forthright apology to the Chinese people. He reached out to other countries, to Vietnam and the Philippines, for example, that had suffered at the hands of wartime Japan. And this role of the emperor as apologizer was a fascinating new departure, but it was also one that brought the emperor, you know, kind of dangerously close to politics. I mean, his role is supposed to be symbolic, but apologies, it's murky, but they're inching pretty close towards politics.
Tell us a little bit about what you referred to the book in your book as the monarchy of the masses.
Under the Meiji system, under the system according to the Constitution of 1889, the emperor commanded the hearts of the people, and he was often kept above the clouds to maintain his mystique and authority. But the post-war constitution defines the emperor as the symbol of the state and the unity of the sovereign people. In other words, if the Japanese people ever decide that they want to be rid of the imperial house, the politicians would have to respond. This means that the post-war imperial house must cultivate the hearts of the people. It must win the affection of the people rather than command the hearts of the people. So their basic operational style has undergone fundamental change. They need to be out there mixing with the people. They need to be paying attention to whether their performances are being judged positively by the people. And they keep their fingers very close on the pulse of what the people think of the imperial house, and then they respond. Just to give one example, the Emperor Emeritus Akihito, from the time he became crown prince, kept a map of Japan in which he would put pins of a certain color representing places he visited first as crown prince. And then they switched to a new color once he married, representing places that he and the crown princess had visited. And their goal was to visit basically as absolutely many places in Japan, including in remote areas, and mix with the people in order to shore up support for the imperial house, but also to lend their prestige to various meaningful societal causes. For example, they spent a lot of their time lending their prestige to the weakest members of society, for example, individuals with physical disabilities. And so today's imperial house in Japan is out a among the people.
We're going to take a short break. With us by phone from Portland State University, Oregon, is Dr. Ken Ruoff. He is the author of his newly released book, Japan's Imperial House in the Postwar Era, 1945 to 2019, published by the Harvard University Asia Center. It is available now on Amazon or your preferred book vendor. The coronavirus contagion, my friends, that is sweeping the world is challenging us all. Now, racial, ethnic prejudice, discrimination, and exclusion have no place in any society, especially here in America, a nation of immigrants. I've been reading stories of Asian students and others who have been abused and attacked, some for just wearing a mask, others for just being who they are and associated with things that they are not. America's educational institutions have readily invited young people from Asia to learn and live amongst us, and because of imposed travel restrictions, they can't go home to be with their loved ones. My friends across the country, I ask you please to extend the hand of unconditional friendship and compassion to these people. This virus is going to be defeated, and we are going to defeat this together. So please, let's join hands. Let's show ourselves as Americans at our best and to show compassion. And as we like to say in Hawaii, aloha. So I thank you very, very much. My name is Jeffrey Bingham Mead, and I am your host. Welcome back to Conversations in Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead on Radio 1490 WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut, and WGCH.com anywhere. I am Jeffrey Bingham Mead, your host, and my guest today is Dr. Ken Ruoff of Portland State University. We're discussing his fantastic book, Japan's Imperial House in the Postwar Era, 1945 to 2019. Ken, thank you very much for staying with us through the break. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Got to ask you, after ascending the throne in 1989, Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko went through extraordinary efforts to narrow the distance between themselves and the ordinary Japanese people. You've alluded to this already. And I was wondering if you would give us maybe a backstory about this. And again, maybe you've already said this, but what are the ramifications of this for the monarchy?
Yeah, I'll be happy to answer that question. Just let me affirm again your call for tolerance. I can't stress enough how important it is, as someone who regularly visits Asia, that we put forth the good America, because the bad America is getting an awful lot of attention. Akihito and Michiko were, in fact, experimenting with a new style as crown prince and crown princess, but it was only after they became emperor and empress that the new style came to be widely known. And frankly, it was quite startling for a lot of Japanese, with most liking it, even adoring it, but some people thinking it was beneath the dignity of the imperial house. And there were two iconographic moments in particular, both actually associated with natural disasters. In July 1991, Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko traveled to meet with individuals displaced from the eruption of Mount Unzen. That's down in Kyushu. And this had actually resulted in casualties as well. The setting was along the lines of a school gymnasium, and so there's lots of displaced people gathered there. And the emperor and empress come in, and then they sit. They sit on the floor at the same level of their countrymen and engage in free conversation with them, often consoling them. Of course, this was being broadcast throughout Japan on television, and there were many still photos of it. Japanese were amazed. I mean, the previous emperor and empress never would have felt comfortable doing that. And so it was a literal narrowing of the distance between the imperial couple and the people. But Empress Michiko would take it even a step further after the terrible 1995 earthquake, the one that was centered on but not limited to Kobe. And so during a visit there after the earthquake, Michiko hugged one of the distraught survivors. And of course, this was also captured by TV and still cameras. And so all Japanese became familiar with this further narrowing of the distance between the imperial couple and the people. Now, there is a small minority of critics who argue that it is unseemly for the imperial couple to mix this closely with the people, that it's beneath the dignity of the institution. But they don't have a monopoly on the definition of dignity. And the vast majority of Japanese approve of this style, which, by the way, by now is just accepted as the norm.
Yeah.
At this point, many Japanese, younger Japanese, don't know, unless they watch documentaries about the history of the Imperial House or read a history of it, that the Imperial House ever operated any differently than the present style of mixing as closely with the people as possible.
I wanted to know if you would talk to us about Akihito's abdication, the issue of the imperial succession, and also what thoughts and predictions do you have for the future?
Well, the main reason that Emperor Akihito abdicated, and we should all keep in mind that these 28 surviving monarchies pay very close attention to each other, and there were five abdications from 2006 onward that came before Emperor Akihito abdicated. And so the real question is, why this wave of abdications? In a democratic society, a monarchy must keep in tune with the trends of the time.
Yeah.
If Akihito had waited until March 2025 to abdicate, or if he had lived that long or even longer, which is totally plausible, Japan would have faced the scenario of one senior citizen emperor passing on the throne to another senior citizen,
yeah.
Which, you know, for younger Japanese, you know, reasonably they could ask, what does this senior citizen monarchy have to do with us? Mm-hmm. And so in order to renew the monarchy, he abdicated. And in order to keep it in tune with the trends of the time. Now, the new emperor and empress, so far, it's largely been stayed the course with what came before. There was a sad, another bad natural disaster right before the formal enthronement of Naruhito in October of last year. And so, for example, they've made visits to encourage their countrymen to rebuild. But there's some areas where there are new departures. The new emperor has been referencing over and over the fact that Japan is diversifying in all different ways. And therefore, there's a tremendous need for tolerance. He is coming back to this message over and over and over. And there's another issue that the Japanese are going to have to deal with. This system limits the throne to males. Only males can ascend to the throne. And it's of the major monarchies, it's the only one besides Saudi Arabia that limits it to males. And I'm not so sure that Japan in the area of women's rights wants to be categorized with Saudi Arabia. So the question is, do they change the law to allow women to ascend to the throne? Public opinion polls suggest that 80% of Japanese are in favor of that, but there's an intense minority that's waging an all-out battle to preserve the male-only system. And at this point, Prime Minister Abe is saying he wants to preserve the male-only system. So we don't know how this is going to play out, but it's no exaggeration to say that the entire future of the throne rests on the shoulders of the only boy among the younger generation of royals, Prince Hisahito, 13 years old. The entire future of the throne rests on his shoulders, and that's a very, very fragile situation indeed.
Well, my guest today, my friends, has been Dr. Ken Ruoff. He is the author of Japan's Imperial House in the Postwar Era, 1945-2019. It's just been released, published by Harvard University Asia Center, and available on Amazon or your preferred book vendor. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. You're welcomed here anytime, and I thank you for being with us today. Thank you.
Oh, very much my pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to today's Asia Today show with Jeffrey Bingham Mead, broadcasting to all four corners of the world from Radio 1490 WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and from WGCH.com anywhere via live global streaming over the internet. Learn more about the show at radioasiatoday.blogspot.com. All shows are archived and made freely available on podcast.com, SoundCloud, and the shows and hosts section of WGCH.com. We thank you for listening, and we thank our supporters and advertisers for making this show possible. We would like to invite you to join as an advertiser as well. As we like to say at my home in Hawaii, ahoi ho kakou, until we meet again. We'll be back next Saturday morning, starting 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. See you then.